This is Spiro Rondos for Concordia University. With me today is Benjamin Fung, assistant professor with the Concordia Institute for Information Systems Engineering. He is also a research scientist at the National Cyber Forensics and Training Alliance Canada, also based at Concordia. Professor Fung's work has attracted many research grants, and he has published dozens of articles on data mining, privacy protection, and cyber forensics. Most recently, his research in email authorship analysis garnered global media attention. Also with me is Lynn Perrault, Director of the Electronic Commerce Enforcement Division at the CRTC. She is responsible for ensuring Canada's new anti-spam legislation, Bill C-28, is respected. Before joining the CRTC, Perrault was Executive Director of the National Cyber Forensics and Training Alliance Canada and a Computer Forensics Officer in the Electronic Evidence Unit of the Competition Bureau. She has more than 20 years' experience in internet forensics and policy development. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Okay.
Professor Fung, I will ask you to describe some of your work, especially as it relates to cybersecurity, which is very much in the news these days.
Cybersecurity is a hot research topic in both the IT industry and academia. And 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Department of Defense has just officially announced that it now considers cyberspace to be the fifth dimension of warfare, in addition to land, sea, air, and space. And this decision pretty much reflects the fact that the critical infrastructures in our society, such as the telecommunications, transportations, financial systems, operate in the cyberspace, and we cannot afford to lose any of these systems in any day. And this system directly or indirectly depend on other services in the internet. However, the internet itself inherently is not a secured environment since the day one it was invented. The purpose of the internet, original purpose of the internet, is to share information, not to protect information. However, in the last decade, we start to perform all sorts of secure transactions operations like e-business, e-bankings, on top of this insecure environment. And currently, we are in the phase of transformation. We are in the phase of transforming from an insecure environment to a more secured internet environment. And I believe it will take some time and efforts for this transition to happen. And my research topic, my research specialty is in data mining, which is a process of extracting large volume of knowledge and information from some raw data. And in particular, I'm interested in developing new data mining solutions that can help crime investigations and privacy protections.
I'll ask you to expand on some of this research in a moment, but Lynn Perrault, about Bill C-28, we'll get back to that in more detail later on, but let's begin with spam. How big a problem is it, and is it what kind of toll is it exacting on Canada?
Well, I don't know that anybody knows exactly how big an issue it is, but we do know through the ISPs that approximately 80 to 90% of all email traffic globally is considered spam. And the ISPs are doing an excellent job at filtering this out. So we are seeing less and less spam in our mailboxes, but nonetheless, they are a large burden, you know, on the bandwidth and on the ISPs in terms of filtering and the cost to their business platform. So there is that issue. In terms of, as I said, how big it is in Canada, I'm unsure of the numbers per se, but I do know that there are upwards of 30 command and control botnet servers in Canada identified, and this number fluctuates from time to time, and there's certainly probably more than that we know of. But one command and control server, a botnet server, can disseminate voluminous amounts of spam. And identifying these command and control servers are going to be a key issue, and then of course that will help with the spam traffic as well.
Professor Fung, we talked a little bit about your work in email authorship analysis and how it was reported all over the world. A lot of newspapers picked up on it. Mm-hmm. I think even radio shows. Can you describe for me what that is?
Sure. Our research team includes several PhD students. Under the co-supervision of Professor DeBarbi and myself. has developed a data mining solutions to systematically extract the write print from emails. And the idea of write print is an analogy to fingerprints, which we can uniquely identify the author by matching the writing styles, given a small group of suspects. And in some scenarios, it's even possible to infer the gender or the or the nationality of the author by matching the writing styles.
So potentially, police forces, courts can use some of this technology to find the perpetrator?
Yes, it's applicable to different phases of the investigations. We particularly focus in email because email is still the most popular way to distribute malicious contents, let's say phishing websites or viruses or spams. And so our method can help the investigation at different stages of the investigation. For example, in the early stage of the investigations, the investigator may have little clue to start with, given some anonymous emails, and our method can infer the characteristics of the author, such as the gender or nationality, education level of the anonymous author. And in the later stage of the investigations, when the investigator has a better picture, let's say he may have a group of suspects in mind, at that stage, our method can help the investigator to identify the true author by matching the right print and with presentable and explainable evidence, which is very useful in the court because our method allows the expert witness or the investigator to pinpoint a piece of evidence that can support the conclusion. So this is useful in the court.
From a layman's point of view, that seems to me that that kind of research may help you, Lynn Perrot, in your work at the CRTC.
Well, absolutely. I mean, in any law enforcement environment, in terms of cybercrime, attribution is the most difficult aspect because you may be able to trace a spam email back to a particular location, but it's very difficult to identify who, in fact, authored that particular spam email or, in fact, pushed the button. And this type of software, this tool that Dr. Fung has developed, will certainly help us when we are able to trace it back to a particular location, to zero in on that individual at that location, who may be involved in this particular activity.
Is Bill C-28, I mean, describe that for us. That in force? Will some of these enforcement abilities be embedded in this Bill C-28?
Sure. Let me give you a little bit of background. In 2004, a spam task force was struck to study the whole issue of spam. And, we were one of the last countries to come to the table with an anti-spam legislation. And that allowed us to look at other legislations and really take the best from all of them. So in 2005, the Spam Task Force tabled its report with a number of recommendations, and from those recommendations, the new legislation was born. A number of iterations came to table and died because of changes in government, but now we are, have a bill that received royal assent in December of 2010. The regulations around the legislation have just been posted for consultation, defining further some of the nuances around consent, et cetera. And when that is all approved and tabled, we should get a coming into force of the legislation somewhere around the end of the year, very beginning of 2012. The legislation will be enforced by three agencies, the CRTC. The Competition Bureau will handle misleading content and misleading headers. They are the only agency with a criminal power, and this won't change, but they've already had the misleading content as part of their purview under the Competition Act. This is just a slight change. And the Office of the Privacy Commissioner will also be handling areas such as phishing, spyware, email address harvesting. But all of these will invoke the CRTC, because the CRTC has the largest purview under the new Act, which includes unsolicited commercial email messages, spam. We also will be looking at botnets, man-in-the-middle attacks, so the network rerouting, unauthorized network rerouting, the downloading of malicious software as well. So all of these, so the botnets are the largest in terms of its dissemination ability for spam. And so the malware, the phishing, the spyware, you know, all the misleading content are all going to sit on top of this. So there is some collaboration that will happen between the three agencies. But the CRTC really does have the largest purview under the, the largest responsibility, I should say, under the Act.
Professor Fung, does your technology target, Lynn Perrell just talked about botnets and phishing and all kinds of other, I guess, malicious pieces emails that are sent to users' computers. Does it target specific types of malicious email? Or just the authorship?
Because in order to deliver those malicious content, they usually do it by email or from websites, and if we want to identify the original author, it could be applicable to those problems, but not particularly on examining the exact the virus or the malicious code. But we can analyze the writing styles in that email or in those phishing emails or websites to match the original author of the.
Once you have authorship, established or there's a suspicion, how strong is that in a court of law?
Currently, for the authorship identification part, the average accuracy is about 80% to 90%. From a data mining perspective, having 80% to 90% of accuracies in such a tough problem is already very encouraging. But for the court, it's insufficient to have 90% of accuracy. We cannot just prove someone to be guilty given 90% of accuracy. Yes.
Yeah.
But again, our method is useful in different phases of the investigation, especially in the early stage. And in the later stage, our method can even identify some patterns that are not obvious to even a linguistic experts. So we can speed up those writing pattern, write print matching process. Our intention was not to replace an expert witness in the court. We still expect the expert witness will re-verify our experimental result or our result generated by the program before presenting to the court. So this is the purpose of the program.
No.
If I may interject here, the interesting thing about the new legislation is that it is a civil regime, it is not a criminal regime.
Mm-hmm.
And while we will investigate as much as possible to the criminal standard, the burden of proof, it's on balance of probabilities, is not the same as under a criminal standard. And the detail that Dr. Fung's tool can provide for us can be one more detail coupled with perhaps IP tracing and so forth that will, speak to that balance of probabilities. So our burden is a little bit less under the civil regime, and the CRTC is a commission, and so the violations that occur or that will, the notice of violation, the enforcement portion of the legislation is done within the CRTC at the commission level. So it's only when there's an appeal that it's actually going to go into a court.
Okay, so if there's a violation, you can't bring charges yourself. You have to pass it along to another branch. Am I correct?
No, because it's a civil regime, the notice of violation is akin to bringing charges.
Okay.
The only entity, as I indicated, is the Competition Bureau, who has currently has criminal powers, and they also have civil powers as well, mm-hmm. but only, in terms of this legislation, in the misleading content portion, so in the content and in the email headers. For the CRTC and for the OPC, it's a civil regime, so the burden of proof is different. Mm-hmm. And this tool, this attribution tool, authorship tool, will go a long way in helping us bring our case to fruition. And there's a number of tools available to the commission, and they could enter into a settlement agreement based on the proof that we acquire. The target could enter into an undertaking with the CRTC, and of course we can bring a notice of violation. Mm-hmm. And the amps that are allowed for under the legislation are the highest among any anti-spam legislations.
Amps are?
Yes, I shouldn't use an acronym. It's administrative monetary penalties that are associated with
a notice, basically.
A fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Very substantial, $1 million per violation maximum for an individual and $10 million per violation for any other person, meaning, for instance, an organization, a company, per violation. So there are some parameters that help us define the amount of the fine, but conceivably, you could potentially fine somebody per email sent out. I don't think that'll occur.
If you could calculate the cost.
Exactly. If you could look at the scope of the impact of the actual activity, the scope of the problem, if there were recidivism, if this person was a known violator continuously, perhaps you know there had been a number of other notices of violations issued, then, of course, the administrative monetary penalty is going to be substantially higher.
Mm-hmm. Professor Fung, the research obviously got the CRTC's attention. Other law enforcement agencies, did you receive many emails, or phone calls of interest after the reports came out?
Yeah, after the reports came out and after the media reported, and I received many emails from different private investigation firms, from different law enforcement agencies around the world, and even from victims. I still remember in the week that the media reports our result, I received over hundreds of threatening emails forwarded by the victims and asking me to identify the true author, although I didn't have time to work on every case. But clearly there's a demand in this area.
And were those emails of interest from around the world?
Yeah, from US, from UK, from South Africa, and everywhere. Yeah,
very interesting. Yes. At the top of our conversation, you mm-hmm. were talking about the internet, and it was invented for the free flow of information. But now mm-hmm. we're asking on the internet to piggyback banking and e-commerce and so forth. The two seem to be contradictory. Are we asking too much of the internet? I mean, we want our privacy. We want to protect our transactions, but we also want the free flow of information, which was the original intent of the internet. Are we asking it too much? Is it possible to do both?
I am optimistic to see that it's actually possible to perform secure operations or secure transactions, even though the internet itself is not a secure environment. By using different techniques like encryptions or cryptography, we can achieve those difficult tasks. I agree it's difficult, but I think it's still achievable.
Which was my next question for you both, and that's, can we stay one step ahead of the criminals? Are you smarter than they are?
In some scenarios, it's possible. For example, in botnets, let me just briefly talk about botnets. In botnets, there's a hacker who distributes the malicious code, maybe through emails or through websites, and once a computer gets infected, it may still perform normally as usual until it receives some command from the hackers. So the computer becomes a servant or a robot for that particular hackers. And the hacker, for example, can give a command, say, we want to attack a particular web server to bring down that server. So some of my colleagues in the security team at Concordia University, they are working on identifying the server and dismantle those botnets before it actually gets, it causes any real damages. And in that aspect, they demonstrate some success in that area. However, I agree with you, in some scenario, it's similar to preventing fire or preventing crime. It's not possible to completely eliminate all sorts of cyber crimes. But in that area, we can actually limit or restrict the damages within a certain scope, and by implementing new privacy protection techniques or implementing or researching new intrusion detection techniques, it is possible to limit the scope of the damages.
Let me tackle that from a law enforcement perspective. The reality of the situation is that there are limited resources available to law enforcement. And it's probably the most notable area of law enforcement where partnering with industry and academia and other law enforcement across the globe is going to be so important to be successful in this area. We understand that we cannot, number one, do it all, because we would certainly there are not enough resources to tackle this global issue. And secondly, we can't certainly know it all. And we need to partner with research specialists such as Dr. Fung, with other industry partners who are seeing the trends and the threats as they happen to their networks. They know what is happening at that moment. We don't have that view, that immediate view or real-time view of the situation. So partnering is going to be paramount to making this a success. And organizations like the National Cyber Forensics Training Alliance Canada and its sister organization in the US, and there are a number of other ones that are starting up globally in the UK and other areas as well. It is through these nonprofit organizations that bring together academia, industry, law enforcement, government, et cetera, to tackle the cybercrime issue, where we're going to see, I think, a large success. It's a new concept for law enforcement. We tended to work in silos, and once we get the information, we want to keep it there. Under the civil regime, we're a little bit more open to partnering and having this free flow share of information, so much so that the legislation itself has a section that allows both industry partners to share with us and for us to share internationally with our law enforcement counterparts.
We're still at the infancy of these exchanges, I imagine. Is there any resistance to partnering? Say, for sometimes industry is worried about trade secrets, or the ISPs are known for not wanting to share information, and they have mm-hmm. customers. Is there resistance? Are you working these things out?
Yes, there's definitely resistance, and exactly for the competitive issues that you speak to. And it's the NCFTA is a perfect venue for the sharing of that information. There are non-disclosure agreements in place. Any information that gets shared is anonymized, so that the competitive identification is not shared. The personal information is also stripped out to deal with the privacy issues. Although not under the legislation, what is contemplated for Canada is a spam repository center, where consumers can complain, send in their complaints. They can also feed us with data samples, so their spam emails, et cetera, that they've received, they can send it here. And we're working with the industry partners, ISPs and the like, to send us their data. So they're filtering a good portion, as I said earlier, 80 to 90% of all traffic is considered spam. Well, they're filtering that out, and they're willing to forward that to us through the Spam Repository Center. So again, here we have another neutral ground where information can be brought in and accessed by the enforcement agencies to further the compliance and enforcement activities under the new legislation.
Let me ask you about, since we are talking in a university, about education and awareness, are tangentially related anyway. Professor Fung, what about education? Students being educated properly to deal with these issues at Concordia?
Yes. Education is actually very important in cybersecurity. And in fact, training is one of the primary objectives of NCFTA Canada and our institute, like Concordia Institute for Information System Engineering. In our CISC, we have a specialized master program in information system security, which is organized by 6 faculty members with different security backgrounds, from cyber forensics to privacy protections, from network system security to cryptography. And the students in our program has the opportunity to learn or even to develop new techniques for IT security, and including for fighting cyber crimes. So due to the high demand of security experts in the job market, they usually get very good job offers after they graduate, and from different government agencies or from different IT firms. And in addition to training the new generation of security experts, it's equally important to educate the general public about the security and privacy threats or risk in the cyber world.
Lynn Pillow, do you feel that the Canadian public gets it, understands how big the threats are, or are they concerned?
Well, I'd like to say yes. And I think there's definitely some concern in terms of the security issues. And they understand that, you know, there's malware, et cetera. But we understand in law enforcement that the weakest link is, in fact, the general public who clicks on that link that they're not supposed to click on. Curiosity is always an issue. The social engineering is phenomenal in these new phishing emails, in the various spam emails, driving people to click on something or download something, or even contained in the email itself without their knowledge. And then, of course, they become infected. And then there's the worst type of social engineering, where a targeted group, demographic, is targeted, such as the elderly, who are literally stripped of their wealth through social engineering. These are the unfortunate situations that you deal with, and I think outreach and education is a very, very important part of what NCFTA, law enforcement, academia, the whole sort of cybersecurity industry really should take an active role in educating the consumer, the user, the internet user.
Is anybody doing that? I don't notice any information campaign out there.
Absolutely. As part of NCFTA, we do lots of training. Both the American and the Canadian NCFTA have done lots of outreach. The new legislation, the three organizations or three agencies will be doing a very active outreach campaign, including Industry Canada, who has the oversight responsibility, if you will, in terms of the legislation, will be doing specific outreach for consumers, whereas CRTC will be doing specific outreach for industry. Mm-hmm. So yes, I would venture to say that there is a great deal of information available, and yet, you know, the maliciousness of the content, the social engineering, gets better and better. Mm-hmm. So human nature is what it is.
Professor Feng, you work with a lot of researchers, scientists, graduate students. Do you all feel that you're on the good side? Does it give your work more impetus, knowing that it's valued and that you're contributing to society?
Yes, definitely. And by working with different experts, it gives me the opportunities to work on real life problems instead of just working in our ivory tower. Mm. We sometimes work on a research problem. We never know whether this is actually applicable to real life. But in these research topics, it really gives me a feel that I'm working on a real life problem and I can actually solve some issues for the society.
Yeah, motivated. You came from, I believe, a private industry to teaching, right? Am I wrong?
Before I studied my PhD, I worked in a company, in SAP, yeah, before I joined the PhD program.
Okay. I'd venture to say that once the coming into force of the legislation occurs and we start enforcing the legislation, that Dr. Feng's going to have the opportunity to work with some real live data and test out his tool. And I'm anxious for that to occur.
So are we.
Okay.
So Benjamin Feng, Lynn Perrot, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank
You're
you.
You're welcome.